Welcome to another episode of the Product Coalition European Tour London series, where today I'm really excited to be joined by James Sear and Tim Ramage from Avion.io. Welcome, guys.
Thanks.
Great to have you here. I would need to give first a shout out to our location host, which is Digital Directories here at WeWork in Holborn. Digital Directories is a legal startup which provides a platform for people to make informed decisions about legal issues and contact experts. Originally founded in Paris in 2015, the French site has over 3,500 lawyers, and due to its success, a sister site in Belgium was launched in 2018, followed by Italy and UK in 2019. Now, this tour and every single episode is dedicated to raising awareness and support for bushfire-affected communities and wildlife in Australia. If you enjoy this episode, please do show your support by visiting bushfire.productcoalition.com. I'm visiting 5 cities across Europe to interview over 50 product leaders like Tim and James here to gain insights, knowledge, and experience to share with you, the Product Coalition community. If you've just discovered the Product Coalition, we're a global product community with over 500,000 readers, 6,000 Slack members, and thousands of podcast listeners. Head to platform.productcoalition.com to find out more. Now, before we get stuck in, gents, I need to give a huge thanks to the following brands and people who have been major donors to the tour fundraiser at bushfire.productcoalition.com. First up is User Pilot, which is a code-free user onboarding and adoption tool designed especially for product management teams. User Pilot helps to increase conversion, user retention rates, and reduce churn by guiding new users to their first aha moment with interactive walkthroughs, contextual product tours, and onboarding checklists. It allows product managers to build fully customizable, behavior-triggered in-app experiences with a simple visual editor. Go to userpilot.com to get a demo and grab a free trial. Need to give a thanks to Shobit Chug. Shobit Chug is the Intentional Product Manager, a Google product manager that helps product managers become product leaders and have careers they can be proud of. Go to intentionalproductmanager.com and sign up for Shobit's free class on the habits that turn product managers into exceptional product leaders and help them move through their careers fast. Two other individuals that I'd like to thank are Rich Muranov and Chris Miles for their donations. Gents, thanks for joining me.
Thanks.
I'm looking
us.
Forward to chatting about user story mapping. It's cool. We're going to get into that. But first, we've got the icebreaker. In Melbourne, it was a locals guide. In Sydney, it was a pub quiz. And today, it's a game of product inventions, English or not. All evidence is internet-based, so please trust me on this. So I'm going to give you each a question. Let's see how you get on. So first up, the Thermos flask. Let's go with yourself, Tim. Thermos flask, English or not?
So, I mean, that's all about keeping it either really hot or really cold. So I'm going to say it's probably not England. But I don't really feel like we have a massive need for.
So it is English.
Oh, okay. Well, there we go.
One of the greatest British inventions is the Dewa flask, vacuum flask, or more commonly known as Thermos flask. There isn't a Mr. Thermos, but there is a Sir James Dewa invented the first vacuum flask in 1892 whilst carrying out experiments in the field of cryogenics. His invention became a great tool for chemical experiments and obviously later a common household item. Next up, James. Google Maps.
Google Maps. I'm going to say no.
Not English?
No, it doesn't feel like it. It feels like it's got to come out of the US.
Australia.
Australia.
Yeah, right. Not English. So Danish brothers Lars and Jens Rasmussen developed the platform for Google Maps in Sydney in the early 2000s. Along with Australians Neil Gordon and Stephen Marr, they founded a small startup company called Where2 Technologies in 2003. The following year, it was bought by internet giant Google, which also hired the four men, and the technology was turned into what we know as Google Maps. Now, if you had to go from here for a cup of tea with the Queen in Buckingham Palace, would you choose cab, tube, rideshare, bike, or scooter, or walk?
I'd walk.
No matter what the weather?
No matter what the weather. I do walk in the rain, to be fair.
Do you?
I do, yeah. Okay. I like my walking, but I don't know the distance.
Right, okay.
And that's a key, that's a key part to this. So it totally depends on distance. But if it was less than 40 minutes, I'd walk it.
See, I could see you on one of them electric scooters.
No, not for me at all. No, too dangerous. I'm not like a risk taker at all.
Right,
I'm totally adverse to risk.
Tim, would you scooter to Buckingham Palace?
No, I'd also walk for sure. Yeah, but obviously, again, depending on the distance.
I don't know, walking in London can just be as just dangerous as scootering if you're not paying attention.
Yeah.
With your heads up and looking at the fact. So let's get stuck into user story mapping for modern product teams. Firstly, gents, do you mind sharing your product journey or path as to what's been your entry into product and got you to where you are today?
Sure. I mean, I love to build things ultimately. Ever since I was a kid, I was always sort of tearing things down as opposed to playing with them and just trying to figure out how they work. So I studied computer science at university and then basically found myself working at an agency through a placement year during my university course. So from there, I essentially just dropped out of uni, never went back and graduated. Right. I just loved it too much. It's just a great feeling to be working on lots of different projects, building lots of different things, working with lots of different companies. It really gave me a lot of exposure into different technologies. And yeah, it was just a whirlwind at the time.
Nice.
Yeah, and I'm pretty much self-taught in terms of software engineering. Went to university and studied music, but kind of ended up falling into building websites effectively and ended up at the same digital agency as Tim. And we kind of, you know, became friends. And actually, we have a pretty cool story. We attempted for charity, we attempted 100 miles on a tandem bicycle. And it wasn't just any tandem bicycle.
Right, okay.
It was a 1978 Peugeot tandem bicycle.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it was an absolute
Peugeot racing tandem.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. I mean, this was like, we found it on eBay and we were just like, I mean, we've just got to have that thing. It looks absolutely amazing.
Right.
I mean, it was clunky as hell. Like, you know, the gears just kept slipping and everything. It was old school gears, like on the things. So anyway, we did these 100 miles then.
So these 100 miles on the roads or on rollers? Like,
yeah, roads.
On the roads, nice.
Yeah, yeah,
nice.
Yeah. I mean, it was like, you know, it was kind of a charity race.
Not around the velodrome.
No. Just leaning in. No, it was a road bike race, but I mean, not many people were doing it on tandems, especially tandems that kept breaking down. But I think, you know, we grew a strong friendship from it, but we learned to kind of trust each other. And actually, it's very difficult to find someone that you want to build something with and go into business ultimately with, which we didn't know at the time. So kind of fast forward, you know, a couple of years, we ended up sort of building a user story mapping tool really as a side project, iterated through a few different ideas, but kind of settled on user story mapping because we were doing it as part of our day job to help all of the teams that we were helping them then build software ourselves. You know, we were typically working in a sort of an agile way, and user story mapping was like the rock. It was the core of everything that we did and still is today. Ultimately, we feel a little bit kind of, I guess, naked if we don't have it as part of, you know, as part of our product workflow. So yeah, we built this tool and we released it out to the world and we had a little bit of success with users and some great feedback. And it felt like we were heading on a path that was worth, you know, really looking into. So we took the plunge and we went full time.
Need to bring it back to the tandem thing. So any tandem based conversation, you've got to ask for 100 mile. Who was at the front?
Who was at the back?
Yeah. Okay, we had a lot here. So Tim is definitely more of a control freak than me.
Right.
So he was at the front.
Right.
I was at the back, so I worked harder.
Yeah, of course.
Worked a lot harder. Right, yeah. I tell you the funny thing was, right, when you're on a normal bike and you're going up a hill, you can just stand up. You stand up and you start kind of like walking on the pedals like you're walking up a mountain. And on a tandem, you can't do that. You have to coordinate with each other.
Right, okay.
So we ended up with this kind of like almost bobbing, like, you know, one would go up whilst the other one stayed down. And it was actually pretty hilarious.
The bike itself was super heavy. The wheel alone, probably weighed more than a full modern bike would these days. You know, like this was solid. I don't even know what it was made from, but it was super heavy. So yeah, I'm not 100% sure how we settled on me being at the front. It definitely, I think it was something to do with heights ultimately. But
put the short one at the back.
I'm sure your thighs did a lot more work than the guy at the back. It's a classic tandem situation.
The funny thing is that the pedals are locked together, so you can't coast at the back. No, you have to. You have to keep moving
unless you do the
legs part, which I did that a few times.
Yeah, right. You just didn't. All right, cool. Okay, so you started Avion.io as a side project. And then what's been the path and the journey so far?
Since we launched?
Yeah.
Good question. So we launched back in August 2018, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was more of a beta period more than anything. And then as James mentioned, you know, we had a lot of success, bit of traction with users, really nice feedback. Some not so good, but some really good. So yeah, that's kind of what set us on this journey to move forwards and actually take it a bit more seriously. And now here we are today.
Great story.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So do you mind, for the audience, user story mapping maybe unfamiliar to some of the audience, could you give us a quick rundown on the theory, the practice, the background,
and yeah,
where it is?
Yeah, sure. So it's one of these tools that I feel like, you know, anyone in product needs to have as part of their arsenal, really. And that's not just product managers and product owners. It's engineers and it's UX, UI, and it's anyone that's kind of involved in really trying to understand what their users want from their product. At a very basic level, the sort of traditional user story mapping would involve using a large wall space and some post-its with some relevant people, you know, in a room. And you have a session where you effectively write down all of your user journeys within your product, which is actually quite a difficult thing to do. Typically, the user journeys are going to kind of start with a verb, but you really need to put yourself in the shoes of the user to understand what those user journeys are to get through that product. Once you've done that, you lay out the steps involved to get through that journey. So you break it down one level further and you do that from left to right. So you kind of end up with this long, very long horizontal sort of thing across the wall. Once you've done that, and that's called your backbone, you begin to flesh out the entire scope of your product and you try and think of everything possible that a user might be able to do, and you place it in context of those user journeys and steps that you've just laid out. You will miss a few things, that's totally fine, and you'll add to it in the future. But generally, you know, this is just a time to get stakeholders involved, throw everything up on the wall and say, you know, this is everything. This is everything we could build, you know, give or take. Once you've done that, you can start to do the most powerful thing in story mapping, which is slicing releases. So you come up with an outcome that you want your users to be able to achieve, hopefully with a hypothesis and something you want to test and maybe even some metrics to measure that. And you draw a horizontal line across your story map, all across your user journeys, and you begin to pull cards from under the line to above the line to get that release done. Now, this is a super powerful, just even putting your mind into that zone is really powerful because, first of all, everything that you're pulling up, you're contextualizing in terms of user journeys. You know, how is the user going to get through this? What's the minimum we can pull into this release to get this outcome out? So it's really, really good for that. And it's also great for having conversations with stakeholders that are rooted in terms of what the user is going to get out of this, not, you know, how the engineering team is going to build it or, you know, how the designs are going to look, but what's the user going to get from this? So that's kind of like, you know, the absolute basics. It goes a lot further than that for us because, you know, we've obviously built a digital tool and for us it means involving user story mapping as part of your delivery process, not just your upfront planning process. But yeah, if you want to know more about it and you don't know about it, the absolute de facto book to go to is Jeff Patton's book. He kind of kicked off this whole thing and inspired both of us really into, you know, really taking this technique seriously. So definitely have a read of that.
So with the amount of walls you must have seen in your time, where does it often go wrong? What are some of the pitfalls in this technique?
I mean, for people new to user story mapping, I'd say a lot of the issues actually arise after you've built that initial user story map. So if we break it down into sort of two sections, the first stage really that all the effort goes in to getting everyone in a room, planning out, okay, what are all our user journeys? Let's map out all of our user stories and let's start slicing some releases. That can take anywhere between, you know, depending on what you're building, maybe half a day to 2 days, perhaps. So that's a huge exercise to go through to get to that point. Now, not necessarily any issues there, but then coming back to it again, to continually iterate on your product, right? To continually look at what you're building, create new releases. Doing all of that with post-it notes can be quite problematic. You know, not only do they fall off the wall after you've moved them at least twice.
Or the cleaners
common thing, you know, coming into the room and seeing 5 post-it notes on the floor and you're like, where were they? You know. So yeah, you know, there's issues there, I think, ultimately with post-it notes. And obviously if you're building something big, if it's a big product with at least 5, 6, 7 user journeys, then you need a big wall to do that, you know, and you need it for a long period of time. Because ultimately, you know, I'd recommend that you're using that user story map to feed into your product backlog as a means of prioritization all of the time. It's not something that we should be doing just to plan the initial scope of what we're going to build. It should be something we use to feed into our regular backlog refinements and prioritization to help us decide what it is we're going to build. So yeah, you know, I think there's some issues there. I think with larger companies as well, it can be quite difficult to sort of say, well, how do we get our product into a user story map? Like, it's just so big. And actually, you know, you have to be pretty good at breaking down those user journeys, perhaps into different delivery teams and what they're responsible for, and allowing it kind of to be a bit more isolated in those kinds of ways. So
I can imagine if you're limited to that physical wall space, then assumptions start to get put in where you don't have enough physical space. So you go, well, in between the two stories you see here, they're going to have to do this, this, and this, but we don't have enough space to show that.
Yeah, and then things start layering on top of each other.
Yeah, right. It gets quite messy.
So sometimes that happens just out of sheer laziness to move a bit, you know, there's such a big chunk of like post-its to the right of where you want to put something that actually moving this is such a pain that it's just easier not to. The other thing we see quite a lot is people using a user story map to almost organize their brain, but not necessarily use it to lay out user-focused journeys. So they'll often kind of lay it out with, you know, almost pages in a website. They'll title things like homepage and you know, sales page or whatever. And if you get value out of it, then ultimately it's just a way of laying out something. But if you really want to use the techniques in terms of, you know, release, you know, planning out your releases and planning out future roadmaps, you know, without kind of strict deadlines and stuff, which is what story mapping is really powerful for, you really need to be thinking about the core user journeys, you know, no matter what your product or system is that you're kind of thinking through.
So Avion's it's a digital tool. You decided not to start a big wall rental company so that people could rent big walls for user story mapping. You built a digital tool instead. Could you talk through some of the advantages of a digital tool here?
Yeah, sure. So I guess the key thing is, like Tim mentioned, that user story map is not something that you just create at the start. You have really great conversations, you get everyone involved, and then you put everything into a backlog tool manually and you forget about the user story map. And all of that context and conversation that you had is lost. And actually, over time, you begin to feel that as a kind of a technical debt that comes back because you're not contextualizing everything. So I think being able to lay it out in a digital tool allows you to kind of take it with the product and the journey. So, you know, that's the fundamental, is being able to iterate on the already existing story map and bring back all those conversations that you had. So the other thing about it, we talked about moving post-its, you know, just being a bit of a pain in the ass, really. You can, you know, with a highly interactive interface, you can drag and drop, and you can do smart things. Like if you'd like to move a whole journey, you can just pick up the journey and it just, you know, everything is kind of a data. You have a data hierarchy there as part of the story map. And that's key, I think. And finally, and this is something that we put an awful lot of time into, was actually integrating with other tools. So instead of having to kind of manually, you know, we did all this work, but then you have to kind of type it all out again. And ultimately that comes down to someone that has to do it. And usually it's going to be a product owner or a product manager. So being able to have the ability, which is what we've built in Avion, is to take a release, you know, you do all that hard work and you just push it. You push it to another tool where the developers are comfortable working as part of their kind of day-to-day, you know, backlog workflow, sprint workflow, and they can start to deliver that and everything stays in sync in the background. So if details change and stuff like that. So I think they're the core things for digital tooling. I think there's more stuff in the future that, you know, is going to kind of come out of that. But, you know, I think that's what we see the greatest advantages.
What does mastery of user story mapping look like? What are some of the top tips to really excel at making the most of this tool or this technique, regardless of the tool?
I definitely, you know, want to hammer home the need to actually continue with a user story map once you've built it, right? You know, the problematic thing of moving post-it notes and doing all of that manually becomes such an issue that, you know, a lot of teams just stop there and then, you know, move it to a flat backlog and don't really come back to it. But you waste a lot of value if you've put all that effort into making a story map that you don't then continue to use going forwards. So for sure, I know it sounds almost obvious to say, but you need to be using that user story map as a means of prioritizing going forwards. So yeah, that one for sure. Another thing I would say is always making sure that your backbone, the walking skeleton across the top, is framed from the perspective of your users. It's quite common sometimes you see people might just put, you know, homepage or whatever it is at the top, right? And that might be fine from a development perspective because it helps the dev know, okay, cool, yeah, that's where this user story is going to be sitting, or, you know, that's what it's related to. But actually, it doesn't help you sort of empathize with what the user is trying to do, right? And if you can frame your user stories in the context of your users and what they're trying to achieve, then you're going to be effectively writing user stories that are going to deliver more value and actually solve a problem. So for sure, that as well. Moving on from that, getting more advanced here, obviously the release planning side of things is super powerful with user story mapping. But if you can make sure that your releases are as lean as possible and you're releasing frequently, so your releases aren't necessarily tied to sprints, then, you know, you're being a lot more agile, you're being a lot more free. And obviously that's that's a really great place for a team to be. A lot of the time we'll see some people, especially in Avion and other tools, planning like a whole quarter's worth of work, right? And it's just, you just can't manage things like that. So yeah, keeping your releases as lean as possible so that they're based on one simple outcome for a user, for sure, that's, you know, great place to be.
One of the other things that, you know, we actually find some of our more advanced users are doing is they're actually creating two separate release plans. Right. And being able to weigh that up with stakeholders, saying, you know, this is one way we could deliver the next, you know, half a year's worth of features, and this is the order that we can do it, or we can do it this way. And actually, by being able to define two different ways of doing it, you can start to align a little bit more with the business objectives as to, you know, really what you're trying to focus on delivering, whether it's, you know, trying to make more profit out of a particular area in a product, or whether it's just trying to drive brand awareness. So that's a more kind of advanced way of using it. Another thing you can do as well is mapping out your current user journeys. So if you've never mapped before, mapping out your current user journeys and actually mapping out another set of desired user right. journeys. You know, it could be that you're looking to transition your product into another way of working, whether it's a new technology or whether it's just a whole new way of approaching the user and really trying to get them involved. And just having those two different scenarios can really help open everyone's mind a little bit more to, you know, the power.
I can certainly imagine that, particularly that user, if you're a new product manager coming into a product, using that almost that regression approach to fully understand the value that's already in the product before you take the reins.
Absolutely.
Can I ask, for teams that are continuously delivering and not delivering in sort of buckets of features or releases with sort of big wrapped up brackets around them, does that change the way a dev team would use, any product team would use a story map and go about sort of putting things above the line?
I don't think so. I mean, I see delivering in releases as absolutely part of continuous delivery, because, you know, it's about keeping those releases lean. And how you, like, obviously you can just, you know, you can just pluck, you know, stories as stuff comes in, you know, in a more kind of a Kanban fashion, as requirements come in from perhaps higher up in the business, you can just start, you know, you've got them in your user story map, you've got them contextualized by the user journey, and you can start just kind of pushing them through and focus on delivering them. But ultimately, if the map's there, you've got the tools available to be able to, you know, plan those releases in a slightly smarter way. So you can still be continuous with how you're delivering things. But as a product manager, you can have a view on the future. You know, you don't have to stick to it. So that's absolutely fine. You can still kind of pull things about, you know, as you're going. It's not a commitment to build any of that stuff.
Nice. From my own experience, how user story maps brings a collective group of people together has been powerful. And I can see the benefit of a digital tool, particularly with remote teams who can't access a wall, and they have to have that uncomfortable FaceTime call where you try and take them through the wall. So I've enjoyed seeing a group come together and really seeing a user story map as a story being told, especially when it starts to get some UX stuff or advocate statements from user experience testing, and they put up a little quote next to part of the story, and so you can really bring it back and build empathy with the whole team of that architecture or whatever.
It does a really good job of bringing, you know, all your teams together around one central artifact, right? Because it overlaps the design, the UX, and the dev work, right? And then it brings it all into one sort of, depending on how advanced you're going to get here, you know, if you've planned out potentially 5, 10, 15 releases, you've got effectively a roadmap that everyone can get behind and see the vision for the next 3 or 4 months. So yeah, really brings everyone together.
With regards to the product management landscape and how digital tools like this, and you know, I love it when I see a tool that's specialized, and you know, I love what you guys have done. You've picked something that's very specific. You've been very intentional about solving a creating a solution for that specific problem. What do you think the sort of future is with regards to product management tools, and how's that impacting the decision and the strategy you guys are coming up with?
I mean, it feels to me like, you know, the engineering side has had their kind of their own digital transformation in terms of tooling. You know, there's so many options now for delivery tools, backlog tools, CI/CD, and just kind of the all-in-one solution is there, or you can just pick and choose different tools if you want to be a little bit more kind of abstract about, you know, what you're using on a day-to-day basis. But I think there's less of that for product management. You know, there's less cohesiveness there with the digital tooling for, you know, collecting user feedback and having that feed into your roadmap, and, you know, roadmapping in a more modern sense, you know, not traditional kind of Gantt chart roadmapping, but actually roadmapping based on, you know, your outcomes that you want to deliver and your releases. So I think what we've seen from talking to users is there's a groundswell happening in the product management world for better tooling to try and take this stuff down. People, you know, people come to us and they show us their spreadsheets. They've always got their own way with some spreadsheet that ties together with some other spreadsheet. And maybe it's got a Zapier, you know, integration or something like that. So, you know, I think there's a lot to come in the future, not only in user story mapping, but in everything around product management. So looking forward to, you know, all the kind of digital stuff that comes out.
It's definitely an exciting time. You know, as you say, dev tooling has matured over the last 5 or 10 years, and we've got a massive wealth of options to pick from. It feels like the project management side has had its time, and now we need to focus more on product management, right? So it's less about what's our velocity and, you know, how many points can we deliver in the next sprint and all that kind of stuff. And it's more about what's our hypothesis here. Let's create a release around what we think we want to solve. Let's put something out there and then let's validate that and tie it all together. And a user story map's a brilliant way of linking those hypotheses and validated tests under one sort of thing, right? We can then learn from and iterate on, and hopefully if we can build more user-centered products that solve people's problems, everyone's going to end up a winner.
Great. Thanks so much for talking through this session. It's been great to record with you guys. I really enjoyed talking through this. Thank you for those listening on the podcast and on the video, on YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, etc. If you've enjoyed this episode or any of the product management episodes of the Product Coalition podcast, please remember I'm spending my time here in Europe recording 50 podcasts to try and raise awareness and funds for the bushfire community of Australia and its wildlife. So please visit bushfire.productcoalition.com if you're keen to help. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you again soon. Thanks, guys.
Cheers.
Cheers.